As we're all aware, Parliament's considering legislation to clarify the powers of the Government Communications Bureau, and under existing legislation, the GCSB lacks the authority to carry out surveillance on New Zealand citizens or permanent residents, but the bill would permit it to do so under certain circumstances if the purpose of the surveillance is to assist public authority or any entity authorised by the minister. So we're going to whiz through, some Research New Zealand polling findings, and Emmanuel Kalafatelis will join us shortly, telling us what they've found when they've asked New Zealanders' views on several matters. First of all, the two of you, how do we feel about widening the powers of the GCSB, and what do you think New Zealanders feel about it?
Well, to me, I mean, any secrets that help reinforce authority are dangerous in a democracy. I mean, I don't think John Key's a nasty, dangerous man or anything like that, but if he's got power, if he's got an increased amount of power in a democracy over me that I don't know about, I'm uncomfortable with it. I think there should be as much transparency as is possible in these things, and I think it should not be just left to the Prime Minister. It should be left to there should be a panel of with a couple of independent people on it you can trust. Especially when John Key said that, you know, those who have nothing to fear have nothing to worry about. That is a very, 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 naive thing to say. Anybody that's read widely about the abuse of power in dictatorships knows that's a very, very dangerous thing to say.
It's willfully disingenuous, isn't it?
Very naive, very naive.
Let's get Emmanuel Kalafatelis on, because there are a few things to talk about. Director of Research New Zealand, of course. Emmanuel, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, John.
Well, first of all, this topic, what was the question you asked people?
This topic, I've only got one topic for you today, Jim.
Oh, okay. We're not doing the rest of them. Oh, that'll be short and sweet.
All right.
But this is the one we're going to do with you today, I hope.
We're going to do the compulsory voting one.
All right. Well, let's do that one.
Yeah.
I can give you, actually, your findings on what the respondents said. And a majority were not in favour of the powers of the GCSB being extended to monitoring New Zealand residents. 52% not in favour versus 36% in favour.
Yeah. No, we did this some time ago, which is why I haven't got it handy at the moment. But I think that's a fairly clear result, although not a resounding one.
No, I suppose you wouldn't call it resounding. You'd call it emphatic in your view?
No, I wouldn't even call it emphatic. I mean, okay. It's, 50-odd to 30-odd.
Yeah.
I would call an emphatic result more like 70 to 80 to 20.
But it's significant, because when you're in a democracy like us, most people really are pretty relaxed about it, don't care too much, don't get off their bike about it. I think it's a significant opinion.
It is a significant opinion. I mean, technically, it is those not in favour are significantly greater than those who are in favour.
And they're younger, too.
Yeah. But I think, actually, Jim, it's all coming back to me now. Haven't we discussed this on the program before?
No, I don't think we've discussed this particular topic.
Right, okay.
But we needn't discuss it in depth, because we have the advantage of you in terms of you're not having your data there, so that's right.
That's right.
Let's talk about compulsory voting.
Yes, let's talk about that.
Yeah, let's talk. And please tell us what you asked New Zealanders about this.
Well, we got onto this subject when the Australians were having their recent elections, and I don't know if the listeners know this, but in Australia, it's compulsory to turn up at a voting booth on election day, although, funnily enough, it's not compulsory to cast a vote. So you can turn up but still not cast a vote. Anyway, the point that really is that the Australian turnout because of that is obviously a lot higher. Now, in New Zealand, the turnout at general elections has been declining steadily. So for example, in 1984, there was a 94% turnout, whereas in the more recent election, 2011, it was just 74%.
The lowest in a century, wasn't it?
Yeah. So it's definitely on the decline. And so clearly, you know, we're talking here about a democracy, and it's important that something is done to halt that decline, because sooner or later we'll get ourselves into a position where those casting a vote aren't necessarily representative of all New Zealanders.
So when you
asked this question, we had a little bit of an introduction, and we asked people We said to people, in fact, in the 2011 election, the voter turnout in New Zealand was 74.2%, and there was a bit of an introduction to that. And then we asked, in your view, should it be compulsory to vote in general elections? Mm. And the overall result was 56 in favour, 42% not in favour. So, again, that is a statistically significant difference, 56 to 42, but in my view, it's not resounding.
No.
Mm.
The interesting thing about this to me is that they object to compulsion. A lot of, you know, the anti-compulsory vote people say, oh, we shouldn't be compelled to do this. But they're compelled to enrol. You're compelled to do all sorts of things in a democracy. That why not just finish it off by compelling you to vote?
I suppose so, but there's the argument that just compelling someone to turn up at the voting booth in Australia doesn't really change anything, doesn't improve democracy. It just
well, you can't really make people vote. They could go into a booth, it's secret, they could screw a paper up and walk out.
Yeah.
I mean, or they could just write over. So, I mean, I think that makes sense just to make them. And if you're going to turn up, surely you're going to do something about it. I can't see any reason why people shouldn't be compelled to vote because they are compelled to do so many other things.
But you can't make someone care, and that's basically what we're trying to address here. Well, what we're basically saying is in the last election, a quarter of the electorate didn't care enough to get themselves to their nearest polling station. Yeah. And what we're now saying is we will force you to care under pain of penalty.
And I suppose the question, Emmanuel, is whether if you introduce this... Well, your poll seems to think that if you make it compulsory, it will increase the degree, the level of caring. That's what New Zealanders think.
Well, quite possibly. But really, I think whether you make it compulsory or not, or you use other tactics to actually make it easier for people to cast a vote, and so there's been quite a bit of discussion about e-voting, for example... that's a more realistic option at this particular stage than compulsion.
It seems to me that if people knew they had to go, that they would... I mean, at the moment, people drift on and don't go. But if they knew they had to go, they would maybe sit down and think, oh, yeah, which way will I vote? Sort
of. Well, would they, I mean, in the
a lot of people would.
Okay, but in the recent local body elections, you know, when people said I didn't bother to go through that big booklet and look at all the names and I couldn't be bothered ranking them between 1 and 20 and all this stuff, if you made it compulsory, do you think it would actually make them sit down and do that or not?
It may not make them sit down, but a substantial number of people who don't get round to voting would, I think, say to themselves, well, I've got to vote, I might as well think, who are they, you know? I mean, I think it would not be the whole lot. I mean, a whole lot of people are so stupid they wouldn't bother to do anything. But I think a significant number of people who just don't get round to voting would maybe think about it.
But let's look at a recent example of what good voting does in this country. We had a referendum not a million years ago on smacking. With a fairly decisive outcome, and we saw what good that did. And so if that's going to be in people's minds when they get their ballot sheets, well, I could go and vote, but let's face it, my vote gets ignored anyway. This does not inspire people to get motivated to vote, does it?
Well, I think it would. No. I really do think it would. I mean, I think there are a lot of people who would find it inconvenient. They may be working. There's all sorts of reasons why, and they know they have to do it. I think they would start thinking about it. At least a small proportion of them were ahead.
Okay. Well, one thing we can end up with is the way they do it in the United States, where I actually got to vote in the last election I was there for, and it was the most phenomenal thing. You get page after page after page of things you're voting for. You know, from the president down to the local rat catcher, everybody is elected. The sheriff, the judges, you name it, everyone gets elected. And it is impossible to make an informed choice. And we're starting to move toward that direction in this country as well. And the local newspapers, which obviously have their own editorial slants, obviously, but they would print our page of recommendation, be a full page in the paper, of we recommend this candidate, candidate for these various offices. And most people, in the end, they would actually pull that page out and either just take it in and vote straight ticket, or they would take it in as a little cheat sheet because they couldn't remember who to vote for. It gets overwhelming. So when you're voting for the mayor, for your district council, for your DHB, for your you name it, then it does get overwhelming.
Well, I don't think it gets overwhelming, and I don't think... even if it overwhelms... Well, some people. The point I think I'm making is, if you had to do it, you would respond in some a significant number of people would respond in a sensible way.
All right, we'll do some good. Yeah. Emmanuel Kalafatelis, thank you for that interesting poll result from Research New Zealand.
Thank you.
On the panel today, Steve McCabe with Gordon McLaughlin. What would they like to talk about? Gordon, what is on your mind, please?
Well, I've just been thinking overnight about journalism and about the divisions, the political divisions that we have in our society now, and it's showing up in America where there is absolutely no sign of compromise by anybody. People have rigid attitudes towards one another. They have rigid politicians. And I think of journalists. I mean, the bloggers, Cameron Slater, for example, on the right, and Malcolm Bradbury, you know, also known as the bomber on the left. They're more politicians than journalists to me. Now, as a journalist, I look at it this way. You have to have respect for other people's point of view. I disagree with some people stoutly. I'll fight for my views to the end. But it doesn't mean to say that I'm not going to respect the opinions of other people and give them the benefit of their right to think that way. And I use Chris Trotter. I mean, he has a political cast of mind, but he has a respect for facts and others' opinions. And that demarcates him a little bit. When I first went to America in the 1960s, it was a model society in terms of media. They had the right of reply legislation. The ownership of television and newspapers was constrained. People were wonderfully objective. And I was a working journalist at that time, and I was enormously impressed. I look at Fox News now, and I am totally despaired. These people tell lies just to get their point of view.
But it's not just Fox News. People always cite Fox, but there's advocacy journalism across all the media.
Yes,
now.
But there's advocacy journalism and advocacy journalism. Orwell, George Orwell, said that when he got his political opinions firm in his mind, it made him able to be a good journalist. He could still look at things objectively. He could still have respect for other people's opinions. And I think, I mean, I have strong political opinions. If I go along to... Objectivity is impossible. You cannot be entirely objective, but you can try. And it's like being honest with yourself. Nobody is totally honest with themselves, but you can try.
Yes, you can.
And that's the point I make. You can try to get these values and try to achieve these values. And these people don't bother to do it anymore.
Even a number of clever journalists, whatever their political hue, revere some facts more than others.
Oh, yeah. Look, I could imagine that Martin Luther King making I Have a Dream speech in Parliament in New Zealand, and even mainstream journalists would be saying, I wonder what it's going to do to the polls, you know. Is this a politically astute thing to do at this time? What side of the... You know, I mean, that kind of cynical journalism is rife now.
And also, we don't need to be objective when it comes to, for example, civil rights and Martin Luther King. Could you imagine... So he's going to appear on Jim's show one afternoon. We're going to get Martin Luther King on to discuss his fantastic idea of civil rights. And in the interest of balance, we're going to get somebody else on to support white supremacy and slavery, because we don't want to be too, we don't want to be favourite toward this one particular opinion.
Well, that's not
we do have absolute truths, don't we?
Well, no, yes, we do, but that's not a bad idea either. I mean, I don't believe in telling people what they ought to think. I mean, get a white supremacist on, and he'll sound stupid. He will sound as ridiculous as they always do.
Yeah, true.
So, I mean, I believe in balance, and I believe in... I look at... You can't accept extremists. People have extreme views of people who don't tolerate yours, so I discount them. But people have sincere... I know a lot of people in New Zealand here I firmly disagree with, but I like them, and I respect them, and I think they're wrong. And at the back of my mind here, I think, well, maybe I'm a bit wrong as well. And if you haven't got that kind of balance in your mind, you're a destructive person.
Okay, so what's going to have to happen to change the climate we have today, where the shrillest voices are heard and the moderate weighers of facts are not?
Well, it's very difficult, because freedom of speech makes it pretty tough to... The only way you can do it is by having a tone of moderation, by getting newspapers and magazines with moderate approaches to things and tolerant and compromising approaches to things. You can't force it on people. I remember a Finnish Minister of Culture when I was in Helsinki at a PEN conference one, and he said something. He said, when I was a young man, there were lots of things I couldn't say. There were lots of things you couldn't say in society for all sorts of reasons. Now you can say what you like. The problem is no one's listening.
The New Zealand Herald's reporting John Banks has resigned, by the way, from his ministerial posts, effective immediately, and I think we can confirm that.
But did he say he wouldn't a little while ago?
We reported at 4 o'clock.
Was he pushed, or did he?
He's spoken to the Prime Minister this afternoon, and the Prime Minister has accepted my resignation. He still thinks the decision in the Auckland District Court was wrong, and he'll be contesting it, but he's gone from his portfolios. That's the latest news on John Banks. Steve McCabe, what's on your mind?
Well, I was listening to the panel last week, as I do when I'm not actually here, and I listened to a very interesting discussion about plans to put a large new housing development just outside my home of Pukekohe, up in Pairata, right next to Wesley College. And this is, you know, I'll be driving past the very field on my way home this evening, so I'm quite familiar with the area. And listening to it, I kind of got very, very frustrated with this idea that you're going to take what's currently quite pleasant, open farming land and stick 1,000 new homes on it. I mean, that's fine. You know, development is all well and good. I've got no problem with that per se. But I don't think the people who are promoting this idea have actually driven down State Highway 22 and realised what's going to be the implications of this. In particular, Pukekohe, fantastic town that it is. One of the great things that Seoul does on it when we moved there was the fact there's a train line that goes straight into the middle of the city. And I use the train line. I get the train to work every morning. It's a great service. It's routinely late. And part of the advantage, part of the plans to upgrade this is electrification. And as I drove into the city today, there's signs up on the side, you know, it's like, new trains coming, tested very shortly. Except those trains are going to stop at Papakura. Apparently it's going to cost too much to electrify the line down to Pukekohe, despite the fact that there have been proposals for years to, put in a new station in Pairata right next to where these new 1,000 houses are going to go, and then electrify the line to have a seamless journey all the way from Franklin all the way up into the middle of the city. That apparently is on hold. I've spoken by email with Mike Lee from Auckland Transports Committee, who says that he's promoting this quite aggressively, and yet they just can't get traction for it. So what I'm trying to figure out is, why is it that we're trying to expand the population, we're trying to put new growth on greenfields, and yet we're not providing the infrastructure that is absolutely essential to support these new people?
Because Pukekohe under the unitary plan goes from about 20,000 to 50,000.
Oh, yeah, it's a growth city, very, yeah. Very much so, yeah. And it really is an up-and-coming town. We were very fortunate to get in when we did. And the public transport that's available, when it's running, is fantastic, and we love it. But there's this terrible standoff right now where basically Auckland Transport are saying, well, if passenger numbers increase, then we'll improve the service. And yet the passengers are saying, well, we can't increase our usage of the service because it's not there right now. Like on Saturdays, for example, no trains go from Pukekohe.
Yeah.
And so you can't say, well, if people start going on Saturday, then we'll increase it. You need to lay these damn trains on. I'd use it. Yeah. It's a fantastic service.
Build them and they will come.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lay down the line and they will use
it. And we will. We absolutely will. But unfortunately, this standoff is there. And putting houses in Pairata is a great idea, but then provide the services for them, please.
Steve McCabe, Gordon McLaughlin. New Zealand meteorologist Bob McDavitt has been quoted in media saying it's possible new satellite images showing what looks like a boat in the Tasman Sea could be the missing ship Nina. These are indistinct images, and we've all probably glimpsed them, or most of us, captured on September the 15th near Norfolk Island. But New Zealand Search and Rescue Agency has continued to rule out resuming the search until a better image emerges. So if you were in possession of images, before we talk to John McChrystal about this, that could be the Nina, would you launch what resources you could muster and at least fly over it to take a look?
No.
Why not?
Well, I've been speaking, actually, I'm going to pull rank here a little bit. I've been speaking to a couple of boaty friends of mine who actually knew the crew of the Nina. They met them in the Marquesas when several people were sailing across, as often happens every year, from North America down to Australia and New Zealand. And I've spoken to these people today, asking them their opinions on this. And what I'm hearing is that in the 4 weeks that have gone by since this ship went missing, it is extraordinarily unlikely that there is going to be anybody still on the boat, first of all.
Rose Noel.
I beg your pardon?
That's the classic.
Marie Celeste.
Well, there you go. To quote one of my friends, she said, cruisers know many stories of ghost ships, boats that are found drifting without their owners.
Yeah.
But more relevantly, another sailor did comment that she said, I think that those more familiar with the old wooden boats have come up with a plausible scenario of a near instant sinking. What I'm hearing is it's in all likelihood an old wooden boat probably didn't survive. Even if it did, first of all, they're going to The object in question, if it's the Nina or not, will likely have moved apparently a good few hundred miles. I mean, it's a month.
I know, but we have international treaty obligations, don't we? We have a search and rescue responsibility, and you have to assess whether it's worth sending an Orion up to get those clearer images.
And this is the assessment that we're doing. We're saying that in all likelihood, unless there are very, very detailed drift models, which apparently are not likely to be available for that degree of specificity, we're going to have a boat that could be anywhere within a several hundred mile radius. All right.
But isn't it worth a look? Don't you think it's worth... I mean, apart from anything else, if it was the Mari Celeste, if you like, it's empty, it would give some clue to what's happened, how they came to lose the crew, or...
But surely the crew are the primary focus here, and there's no way that these people are still alive.
All right, let's ask maritime researcher and writer John McChrystal, who's kindly joining us now. John, good afternoon.
G'day, Jim. G'day, panel.
G'day, Jim.
Can you give us your view? Could the Nina lack steerage and communications but still have people on board and alive after 4 months?
No, I'm with Steve on that one. She's a wooden boat, and something sudden happened to her for her to have been unable to send out any communication after communication was lost with her, no EPIRB signal or anything else. So it's most likely she was either overwhelmed by the sea or lost her keel and went upside down. So even if this were the Nina we were looking at in these images and she were upside down, it's incredibly unlikely there would be anyone alive aboard. The Rose Noel, which you mentioned before, was different because she was a catamaran and basically couldn't sink, and she was very stable when upside down, and there was a substantial, not huge, but a survivable amount of space inside, and they were also able to cut holes in the hull without compromising the buoyancy in order to get out and about and fish and collect rainwater, that kind of thing. It's not impossible, because nothing is, it seems, in maritime history, but very, very unlikely there will be survivors aboard that boat.
Is it worth, though, the cost of an Orion? I mean, okay, yeah. What if she is right way up? What if they... you have the expertise in this field, not us, but where there's life, there's hope. Is it worth a flight?
Well, to set minds at rest, it would be, depending on the expense.
Would it be a training flight?
Yeah, that's right. I don't see any reason why something couldn't be diverted that wasn't in that vicinity anyway. And bear in mind, we've got to establish the vicinity. This is a month she could have drifted a long way.
Yeah.
So they'd have to re-establish contact with it, whether by photographs or some other means, before we could dispatch anything in that direction. But it would be interesting to know, and it would at least give the family some picture, if they wanted it, of course, of what may have happened to their loved ones. If the ship were the Mari Celeste, as Gordon has suggested, and was found adrift with nobody alive aboard, then that suggests a hasty abandonment, and the fate becomes pretty ghastly to contemplate at that point, I suppose.
Yeah.
I guess it just... It rules out a few possible scenarios and doesn't tell us much more.
John, we've all heard the remarkable stories of survival in the Pacific from the Minerva Reef days right through. And you're saying that it would stretch the limits of human endurance, but they've been stretched before.
They have. The Rose Noel was 119 days, which is a pretty good stretch. Mm. There are fishermen from the Pacific who show up sort of months after they've been given up for lost in the open boat.
There were some Fijians, weren't there, I think, or some Solomon Islanders were away for months.
Yeah, that's right. I think they were Solomon Islanders, weren't they? Then there was another, I don't know whether this one was ever verified, but there were a bunch of Mexicans who were eventually spotted way the heck across the Pacific, 5,000 kilometres distance, and many, many, many days. And the longest I think anyone's credited with having survived at sea was back in 1943, and he was adrift for well over 130 days.
Oh, really?
So it's not impossible, but you need food, shelter, water. And the Nina, in a compromised state, is unlikely to have provided those.
Right. I'd like to offer a comment I got from my friend Toast, who commented that in many ways it's hard watching the family cling to memory like this. She said, "I hope to God that if we're ever lost at sea, our family and friends give up much sooner."
Oh, really?
That was her comment, yeah. That's from a yachty friend who actually knew these people.
There'd be the opposite point of view prevailing among some, though. Yeah. I hope the family and friends never give up.
Yeah.
But, okay. No, you've outlined that well, John. Thank you very much for joining us today. John McChrystal joining the panel, and Gordon McLaughlin, Steve McCabe have been on board today. Thank you very much, Gordon.
It's a pleasure.
Always a pleasure for us too, and Steve.
Thank you very much.
Steve McCabe and Gordon. Checkpoint following. Thanks, everybody. John Banks resigning his portfolios. More on that in Checkpoint, which comes up very soon. We'll see you tomorrow.